Up to this point, I have been discussing the theme of the world as the self from three points of view. Number one, discussing what the self means in Hindu philosophy. The self which you feel yourself to be is an expression and is in fact at root the same as the self, that is to say, the being which is the root and ground of the universe. We went on from that to see how, according to Hinduism, the self manifests itself in the cosmological way, in the breathing in and breathing out all the manifested universes, and then breathing in, withdrawing the manifestation over vast periods of time, of space, vast in length as also vast in brevity. The third step was to see the social order, the human order, as a microcosm of this huge macrocosmic game or leela of hide and seek. And so finally we come to the last consideration, which is the question, in what way and by what means can an individual who is under the impression that he is a separate individual, limited by and enclosed in his bag of skin, how can such a person effectively realize that he is deep down the universal self, the Brahman? This, of course, is a curious question, which reminds me of this famous story of an American tourist in England who wanted to find a certain obscure village. And he stopped a native yokel and asked the name to this place. And this yokel scratched his head and said, "Sir, I do know where it is, but if I were you, I wouldn't start from here." In a certain way, the question, how do I realize the self, is the wrong question. Why is it the wrong question? Because it proposes a journey to the place where you already are. Now, it's true that you may not know that you are there, but you are. And if you take a journey to the place where you are, you will visit many other places than the place where you are. And perhaps when you find through some long experience that all the places you go to are not the place you wanted to find, it may occur to you that you were already there in the beginning. And that is the dharma, or method, as I translated that word, which all gurus, teachers of spiritual development, use fundamentally. They are all of them tricksters, but in the most beneficent sense of the word trickster. Why trickster? Because, do you know, it's terribly difficult, in fact it's impossible, to surprise yourself on purpose. And yet, to be surprised is a great thing. But you can't plan a surprise for yourself. Somebody else can do it for you. And that is why so often a guru or teacher is necessary in this process. But let me say right from the start that a guru, there are many kinds of gurus. First of all, among human gurus, there are square gurus and there are beat gurus. There are gurus like, let's say a great Zen master today. Let's take Oda Roshi at Daitokuji, who is a square guru and a very good one. But you go through regular channels. Then there is a guru like Mr. Gurdjieff, who is a rascal guru, who leads you in by means that are very, very strange indeed. The gurus may be situations. A certain kind of problem or encounter. Even a book can to some extent be a guru. A friend can be a guru. I've often thought of writing a story about a man who is some sort of guru seeker and potential yogi, who goes one day into an automat and sits down at a table where there is another fellow, and he sort of thinks that this man looks wise, and he projects onto him the idea that he is a guru. And he says, aren't you... he says, I feel there's something special about you. And the man says, oh, really? Really, actually, there's nothing special about me. I happen to be an insurance salesman. And this other fellow says, isn't that fascinating how modest he is? And then I want to develop this story. Step by step, they keep meeting each other because they both eat at the same automat regularly for lunch. And although the fellow really is an insurance salesman and doesn't know a thing about these things, it in the end results in the enlightenment of the person who projected this image upon him. There's something like that in a New Yorker article, which was Zen in the Art of Tennis, which you may remember. So there are, as I say, many kinds of guru. But the problem of the guru is to show the inquirer in some effective way that he already has what he's looking for. A story is told of a great Hindu king called Yajnadatta, who one day woke up in the morning and in order to arrange himself for the day, picked up the mirror beside his bed and looked in it and found he had no head. The reason was he had a hangover and he looked in the wrong side of the mirror. One side of an ancient mirror, you know, is polished copper or brass or something, and the other is got some designs on it. He looked in the wrong side and couldn't find his head. He said, good Lord, I've lost my head. And there was a great search he instituted to find his lost head. So we are all in that position. We're looking at the wrong side of the mirror. We're looking for our head. Have you ever thought about that? What if there were no... You would never know what your head looks like. And try to be aware of your head. What color is your head so far as your eyes are concerned? You look around and you can't find it. It isn't that there's something black here that's like darkness behind your head, is there? Behind your eyes. Do you feel there's a darkness there? Is there something black? No. As you turn around, this thing just doesn't have any color at all. It isn't black, it isn't white, it isn't nothing. And yet, to have that thing there, which has no color, no quality of any kind that you can see, is the condition of being able to see everything. Actually, what your head feels like inside is what you see out in front of you. Because, as I said, all that you see out in front of you is a state of the brain. It is the way it feels inside your head. And the things you hear, they're all the way the brain feels. The brain, in other words, is a marvelous contraption. To the extent that it is not present to itself, it is present to everything else. Now, if you get a tumor in the brain starts to become present to itself, and you get feelings inside your senses that are all weird and don't seem to be right with the external world. And that is because something has gone wrong inside your brain. So too, when you see spots in front of your eyes, you are seeing your eyes, but you can only see your own eyes when they are defective. When they are working properly, they are completely invisible. Now, in Hindu traditions, the realization of who you really are is called basically sadhana. And sadhana means the discipline, the way of life that it's necessary to follow in order to escape from the illusion that you are merely an skin-encapsulated ego. And sadhana comprises yoga. From the root yug, which means to join. And so from that, in Latin, we get jungere, to join. And in English, junction, and also yoke. And junction is also the word union, you see. All this derives from the Sanskrit root, yug. A yoke is also a discipline. When you yoke oxen, that is a kind of a discipline. Now, strictly speaking, in the very strictest sense, yoga means the state of union, the state in which the individual self, what is called the jivatman. Jivatman is approximately translatable as ego. Jivatman finds that it is ultimately atman, which equals Brahman, the Supreme Self. So yoga is the state, the strictest meaning of yoga is the state of union, and a yogi means one who has realized that union. But we find that the word is not normally used in that way, in that strict sense. Yoga, in the normal way of use, means the practice of meditation whereby one comes into the state of union, and the yogi means one who is a traveler, a seeker, who is on the way to that point. But again, strictly speaking, there is no method to arrive at the place where you are. And no amount of searching will uncover the self. Because all searching implies the absence of the self. The big self, the self with a capital S. So that to seek it is to thrust it away. and to practice a discipline to attain it is to postpone realizing. There is a famous Zen story told of a monk who was sitting in meditation, and the master came along and said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm meditating to become a Buddha." Whereupon the master picked up a brick that was lying nearby and started polishing it, rubbing it. And the monk said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm rubbing this brick to make it a mirror." He said, "By no amount of rubbing could you ever make a brick into a mirror." The master replied, "By no amount of zazen could you become a Buddha." Zazen means sitting meditation. They react very badly to this story in modern-day Japan. Anyway, what is important, you see, quite radically here, is that the moment you embark, supposing, let me put it in this way, supposing that I say to you, each one of you is really the great self, you know, the Brahman. And you say, "Well, all you've said up till now makes me fairly sympathetic to this intellectually, but I don't really feel it. What must I do to feel it really?" My answer to you is this. You ask me that question because you don't want to feel it really. You're frightened of it. And therefore, what you're going to do is you're going to get a method of practice so that you can put it off. So that I can say, "Well, I can be a long time on the way getting this thing. And then maybe I'll be worthy of it after I have suffered enough." See, because we are brought up in a social scheme whereby we have to deserve what we get. And the price that one pays for all good things is suffering. And people love to boast about how much they've suffered. I find it quite sickening. The people who go over to Japan or India and come back and say, or Tibet or somewhere, "Oh, these awful things that their masters did to us. They made us sit for hours with crossed legs so that when we got up we couldn't stand, and we were aching, and we were hungry and cold and shivering, and we were hit over the head with sticks and things, and all these things we endured. My God, wasn't that tough of us?" And they do all this, you see, and say, "Look at the scars I have. Look at the wounds I got in the battle. Look at all my medals, see, for my valiant spiritual endeavors." But all of that is precisely postponement. Is because one is afraid here and now to see it. If you had the nerve, you know, real nerve, you would see it right away. Only that would be, you know, when one feels you shouldn't have nerve like that. Why, that would be awful. That would be that wouldn't do at all, because after all, I'm supposed to be poor little me, and I'm not really much of a muchness, and I'm playing the role of being poor little me. And therefore, in order to be something great, like a Buddha or a Jivanmukta, one liberated in this life, I ought to suffer for it. So you can suffer for it. There are all kinds of ways invented for you to do this. And you can discipline yourself, and you can gain control of your mind, and you can do all sorts of extraordinary things. I mean, you can drink water in through your rectum and do the most fantastic things. But that's just like being able to run the 100 yards in 9 seconds, or to push a peanut up Mount Tamalpais with your nose, or any other kind of accomplishment you want to engage in. It has absolutely nothing to do with the realization of the self. The realization of the self fundamentally depends on coming off it. You know, the sort of, when we say to people who put on some kind of an act, we say, oh, come off it. And some people can come off it. They laugh and say, they suddenly realize, you know, they were making fools of themselves, and they laugh at themselves and they come off it. So in exactly the same way, the guru, the teacher, is trying to make you come off it. Now, if he finds he can't make you come off it, he's going to put you through all these exercises so that you'll, at the last time, when you've got enough discipline and enough suffering and enough frustration, you'll give it all up and realize you were there for the beginning and there was nothing to realize. But the guru is very clever. He says, all right, if this is the way you have to go, this is the way you have to go. You asked for it. You came to me, I didn't invite you, you see, the guru says. You came to me and I said, I want to learn yoga. Well, he said, yoga is union. You're tattvamasi, you know, you're that. Well, no, you say, I'm sorry, I don't understand that because I only get it intellectually, I don't feel it. Oh, he says, you're one of those. so I see, I've got to satisfy you. The customer is always right, no? I've got to give you all this work to do. Because you can't see directly that this is so. But he's looking at you in a funny way, you see. The guru is always saying to you, you know, what are you doing? What's your game? Imagine, for example, a father confessor. And you feel terribly guilty that you've committed murders and robberies and adulteries and fornications and all kinds of arson and injury to people and financial shenanigans. And you go to this man and say, I am a terrible sinner. Oh, he says, really? He said, I have murdered somebody. He says, how many times? And you think, oh, good Lord, this man doesn't realize how awful I am. And you recite all these things, he's perfectly calm. And then you say to him, well, you don't seem to be very shocked. Well, he said, you haven't confessed any serious sins. He said, what do you mean by a serious sin? Well, he said, what do you think? Well, I don't know, I just feel wrong. I just feel there's something in the basis of me that feels, that tells me that I am not what I ought to be. Could it be that I'm spiritually proud? That I'm egocentric? He says, no, that's not, it's very usual. This is quite ordinary sin. But he says, you are guilty of something. Something really terrible. And what could that be? Well, I have no idea. Now he says, come on. Come on. Go deeper. What is the real sin you've committed? And you think, what, me? I, little me, could do something worse than murder, than worse than spiritual pride? Just little me? I mean, I'm a reasonably well-intentioned person. What could that be? And he looks at you in a funny way. You know, it's a kind of a Kafkaesque situation where you're accused of a crime that's not specified, and yet the accuser says, you jolly well know what you've done. Of course, we can't mention it. Because, you know, it's like those laws that are on the books in the state of California and several other states, where people are accused of the abominable crime against nature. Nobody knows what it is. I mean, it can't be mentioned. It's too dreadful to be talked about. So this guy does the same thing, but it's in a different dimension. You've done it. Huh? Now, what did you do? See? The real crime is that you won't admit you're God. That's false modesty. You won't admit that you're the self in disguise. See, as such and such a persona, such and such a person. You know the word person means mask. The persona, that through which the sound flows. And the mask in the classical drama, Greco-Latin drama, was shaped like a megaphone so that the sound would be projected in an open-air theater. So persona, that through which the sound flows, is the mask. And now we use the word person, which means fake or mask, to mean the real thing. Harry Emerson Fosdick wrote a book, How to Be a Real Person, which if you translate that back into the original meaning, it means how to be a real fake. So the guru challenges, you see. He challenges you. If you raise the question, he doesn't go out and preach in the streets and say, come on, everybody, you ought to be converted. He sits down under a tree and waits. And people start coming around, and they offer him propositions. He answers back. And he challenges you in any way that he thinks is appropriate to your situation. Now, if you've got a thin shell and your mask is easily dispatched with, he simply uses what we might call an easy method. He says, listen, Shiva, come up it. Don't pretend you're this guy here. I know who you are. And the guy sort of twinkles a bit and says, well, I guess you're right. But the people aren't like that. They have very thick shells. And so he has to invent ways of cracking them. So here is how it goes. You what you know to understand yoga, you need to get hold of a good translation of Patanjali, the Yoga Sutra. I don't know which is the best translation. There are so many of them. But a Hindu friend of mine recommends the one in the Harvard Oriental series by Woods. It says it starts out, now yoga is explained. Mm-hmm. First verse. And the commentators say now has a special meaning because it follows from something else that you're supposed to know beforehand. That you're supposed to be, in other words, a civilized human being before you start out on yoga. We don't teach yoga to baboons. And so you're supposed to have been disciplined in, as I told you this morning, artha, karma, and dharma. In politics, sensuality, and dharma, justice. And then you can start yoga. Then the next verse is yogas citta vritti nirodha, which means yoga is the cessation of revolutions of the mind. In other words, you can interpret that at many levels. Citta meaning consciousness, like a pool, like water, like a reflecting pool. If there are waves on that, it doesn't reflect, it breaks up all the reflections. So stop the waves on the mind, and it will reflect reality clearly. Get a perfectly calm mind. That's one meaning of it. Or another meaning of it is stop thinking. Eliminate all contents from the mind, all thoughts, all feelings, all sensations, everything. How will you do that? Well, it goes on to say you do it by certain steps. First of all, pranayama, which means the control of the breath, pratyahara, which means preliminary concentration, Parana, a more intense form of concentration, Dhyana, which is the same. Dhyana is Sanskrit for Zen, and that means profound union between subject and object, and finally Samadhi, which is way out. Now what's happening here? Control your mind, first of all by breathing. Breathing is a very strange thing, because breathing can be viewed both as an involuntary and as a voluntary action. You can feel I breathe, and yet you can feel it breathes me. And they have all sorts of fancy breathing ways in yoga. They are very amusing to practice, because you can get very high on them. That one, you know, where you swing down to this way, you know, sitting in the lotus posture and bending down, and then you can breathe in through the left nostril. Breathe out through the right. In through the right. Out through the left. At the same time, imagine that as you take the current in, it goes into you, it goes right the way down your spine, and goes boing on the base of your spine, and then catches hold of that snake that's supposed to be curled up there, and as you breathe out, pulls it up, out. The snake called the Kundalini, the serpent power, that lies at the center of sexual activity, but has to be dragged up and put in the brain. So they set you at these tricks. And of course, if you are bright, you may begin to realize some things at that point. If you are not very bright, then you'll have to go on. And so next they really get to work on concentration. Concentrate the mind on one point. Now this can be an absolutely fascinating undertaking. I suggest that you try it this way if you want to make experiments. Select a highlight on some bright, some polished surface, copper or glass or something, where there's a little tiny reflection, say of a candle or an electric light bulb. Look at it and put your eyes out of focus so that the bright spot appears to be fuzzy. A fuzzy circle. Now look very carefully at the design in the fuzzy circle, and see if you can make it out. There is a definite pattern of blur, and you can have a wonderful time looking at that. Then go back, get your eyes into focus, and look at intense light. And you can go into it, and into it, and into it, like you're falling down a funnel, and at the end of that funnel is this intense light. And go down, go in. It's the most thrilling experience. Then suddenly the guru wakes you up and says, what are you doing that for? And, well, because I want realization. Why? Because we live in a world of, if we identify ourselves with the ego, we get into trouble, we suffer, we're in a mess. He says, are you afraid of that? Yes. So then, all that you're doing to practice yoga is based on fear. You're just escaping, you're running away. How do you think you can get realization through fear? There's one to think about. So you think, well, now I've got to go on with my yoga practice, my concentrations, my exercises, but not for a fearful motive. And you know that guru, you know, he's watching you, and he's a very, very sensitive man, and he knows when you're doing, you know, he always knows what your motive is. So he puts you onto the kick of getting a pure motive. And that means very deep control of the emotions. I mustn't have impure thoughts. All right, so you go along and you manage to repress as many impure thoughts as possible, and then one day he asks you, why are you repressing these thoughts? What's your motive for trying to have a pure mind? And you find out that you had an impure motive for trying to have a pure mind. That you did it for the same old reason you started out the thing in the beginning, because you were afraid, because you wanted to play, get one up on the universe. And so, eventually, you find out, you see, that your mind is what is called in Sanskrit muda, which means crazy. Because it can only go in vicious circles. Everything it does to get out of a trap puts it more securely in the trap. Every step in the direction of liberation is a new tie-up. So that you started, you know, with molasses in one hand and feathers in the other. That was the original situation of man. The guru made you put them together, see, like that, and said, now pick the feathers off. And the more it is, the more of a mess the whole thing gets. So you get involved and involved and involved by this process. And he, in the meantime, you see, has been telling you, yes, you made a little attainment today, but it was only the eighth stage, and there are 64 altogether. And you've got to get to that 64th stage. And he knows how to spin it out and drag it all out, because you are ever hopeful that you'll get that thing, just as you might win a prize or win a special job or a great distinction and be somebody. That's the motivation all along, only it's very spiritual here. It's not for worldly recognition. You want to be recognized by the gods and the angels. But it's the same story on a higher level. So he keeps holding out these baits. And as long as the pupil falls for them, he holds out more baits. Until after a while, the pupil gets the realization that what he's doing is running faster and faster in a squirrel cage. That he's making an enormous amount of progress and getting nowhere. Like in Alice Through the Looking Glass, when the queen says, here you have to run faster and faster to stay where you are. And so he impresses this upon you by these methods very thoroughly. And at last you find out that you, as an ego, as what you ordinarily call your mind, are a mess. That you just can't do this thing. You can't do it by any of the means that have been held out to you. You can concentrate, yes, you've acquired a considerable power of concentration by doing all this. But you find you're doing it for the wrong reason. And there's no way of doing it for the right reason. See, Krishnamurti does this. He's a very, very clever guru. Krishnamurti says to people, now look, there is nothing you can do to be liberated. because all your efforts in the direction of liberation are phony. They are based on your desire to boost and continue your ego, and that will never lead to liberation. All you can do, he says, is to be aware of yourself as you are, without judgment. See what is. But then, if you can do that, you have no further problem. But if you try to do it, you're in the same mess all over again. So we have Krishnamurti followers who are so busy being aware of themselves and not doing spiritual practices that they can't read any books except mystery stories. They mustn't read any philosophical books, any spiritual books. They mustn't do any meditation exercises or anything like that. They just have to be aware of themselves all the time. Gurdjieff played the same game in a different way. He said, the most important thing is self-remembering. Always at every moment be aware of what you're doing. Watch yourself. Constantly and never, never be absent-minded. So all day, when you know you pick up the piece of paper, you realize, I am picking up this piece of paper. And I'm opening it inside and so on. I know I'm doing it this way, so I'm not asleep. Ordinary people, you know, pick up a piece of paper and in this way, we are really picking up the piece of paper. And so all these people are doing this, you know, watching all the time. Now, where do they land up? I've told this story millions of times, really. Excuse me, but it's very important. When they teach you in Japanese Zen how to use a sword, the first thing that the teacher says to the student is, now, if you're going to be a good soldier, you've got to be alert constantly. Because you never know where the attack's going to come from. And so all soldiers are taught this. Watch. Christians, brethren, be sober, be vigilant. If your adversary the devil stalketh around as a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour, whom resists steadfast in the faith, be on your watch. Christian, dost thou heed them on this holy ground, how the powers of darkness prowl and prowl around, the enemy on every side. Christian, seek not yet repose. Hear thy guardian angel say, thou art in the midst of woes, watch and pray. So the soldier, the sentry, everybody's on the watch, on the alert. Now you know what happens to you when you try to be on the alert. You think about being alert, and then you're a hopeless prey to the enemy. Because you're not alert. You're thinking about being alert. So in the same way, the poor boy who is learning fencing and has a teacher and he's doing duties around the house, the teacher attacks him utterly unexpectedly at any moment. And so long as he's alert, he's a sitting duck. Because he's alert in the sense of staring. He says, it might come from there, it might come from there. Let's check out individually every place from which the attack might come. Check this, check that, check the other thing. It might be this way, it might be that way. While he's doing that, it hits him from a direction he's not thinking about. To be alert, you must not think about any special direction from which the attack might come. You must be simply awake and relaxed. And then all your nerve ends are working, and wherever the attack comes from, you're ready. They liken this to a barrel of water. The water is just sitting there in the barrel. But the minute you make a hole in the barrel, the water immediately is ready to come out of that hole. So in the same way, the mind, when it is in the proper state, is ready to respond in any direction from which the attack may come. So this man is no longer alert in the sense of taut and anxious. Which way is it going to come? See? He's just sitting there. Like a cat sits there. And the minute anything happens, it's right there. Because it didn't have to overcome any set in a direction opposite to that from which the attack comes. If you are set for the attack to come from there, and it comes from here, you have to pull back from there and go there, but that's too late. So you sit in the middle, and you don't expect the attack from any particular direction. So in the same way, all this applies to yoga. You can be watchful, you can be concentrated, you can be alert. But all that will ever teach you is what not to do, how not to use the mind. Because it'll get you into deeper and deeper and deeper binds. You have to let it happen. Just like you have to let yourself go to sleep. You can't try to go to sleep. You have to let yourself digest your food. You can't try to digest it. And so in the same way, you have to let yourself wake up. Become liberated. And when you find out, you see, that there isn't any way of forcing it, that for most people is the only way of getting them to stop forcing it. Because they won't believe when you tell them in the first instance, you've got to do this without forcing it. They'll say, well, that it won't work, it won't happen, because I'm very unevolved. I'm just an ordinary human being. I'm just poor little me. And if I don't force it, nothing will happen. I have people who think that if they don't struggle and strain, they won't have a bowel movement, or whatever it is. They think they've got to do that work in order to make it happen. In other words, all that is based on lack of faith, not trusting life. And to get people to trust life who don't trust it, you have to trick them. They won't jump into the water, so you have to throw them in. And if they are very unwilling to be thrown in, they're going to take diving lessons, you see, in which they're going to go all through, they're going to read books about diving, they're going to do all the preliminary exercises for diving, and they're going to stand on the edge of the diving board and inquire whether this is the right posture until somebody comes up beside and kicks them in the butt. And they're in the water. And it's also with this. It really is. So, now there's an amazing, I must instruct you about this, because it's important that you should know it. And the most amazing gamesmanship goes on in the whole domain of yoga and spiritual practice. You would be astounded. Somebody whom I won't mention, but for whom I have a fairly considerable respect, came up to me a few days ago. I'll just say he's a psychotherapist. And he said, Alan, you should work with me. You know, last night you were going around like a zombie. And this isn't good. that if you would be clear with my work, you would be an incomparable genius. I said, what's your game? I'm very fond of you, I said, you know, but you're playing games with me. I was going around like a zombie last night because I had too much to drink. So, I mean, one of the games in all this is to find a little flaw in you, see? Everybody has a place where they can be jiggled a bit. Something they're a bit ashamed of, and so they think, does this person really know my secret? He's not saying anything because he's polite, but does he really see through me and know that somewhere are the awful awfuls and that I'm a little bit upsettable? This is all part of religious competition. If you go to the Roman Catholics and you've studied, you've been psychoanalyzed, you see, they'll say, well, that's fine, but of course it's not nearly enough. I mean, that's all very well so far as it goes, but, or if you're a Roman Catholic and you go to a Buddhist outfit that's on a missionary basis, they'll say, yes, of course, through your Catholicism, you've learned some of the basic virtues, but of course, Catholicism doesn't go anywhere near the heart of things. In that it doesn't have an elaborate system of meditation like we have. Then you go over to the Hindu school, and they say, yes, the Buddhists go to a certain point. But they do attain a very, very high stage of realization, but there is nevertheless something higher than that, which they don't quite get. And you'll find this all round the world, everybody claiming to have that little special extra essence which the others don't have. Now, why are they doing that? Are they all frauds? Are they all charlatans, all out to get you into their society? Sometimes, yes. But sometimes they're trying to see whether you fall for this, testing you out. This is upaya, skillful method. And if you become falling for that little extra special thing that's just supposed to be around the corner, no? Then they've got you. Or rather, you've got yourself in a mix. And you have to work at that and work at that and work at that until you find out that you were being made a monkey of. But you were being made a monkey of because you could be made a monkey of. You hadn't really arrived where you are. You weren't. You didn't have the nerve to be you. That is to say, to be the self. And so you had always to feel that there was something beyond that. The stage higher. See? So that's why, for example, masonry is such a success. It has 33 degrees. And you know, you can go up that ladder and get higher and higher status. The more degrees, the merrier. There have been things that have vented hundreds of degrees. And they're an immense success. Because you can postpone it longer and longer. Like Achilles overtaking the tortoise. He doesn't overtake it in the problem because we keep dividing and dividing the space between Achilles and the tortoise as he approaches the tortoise. What delays Achilles overtaking the tortoise is not Achilles, but our calculations about how he approaches it. We make the calculations more and more complicated as he gets nearer and nearer to the tortoise. It's only the calculations that put it off. Achilles, in fact, runs right by. So in the same way, you can calculate yourself out of liberation. You can put it off indefinitely by inventing new degrees and new stages. But actually, when you get it, you don't get it. You suddenly see it. It happens instantly. And it happens instantly whether you put in 30 years practice or whether you put in 3 minutes. It's the same.
suddenly it dawns on you that that's the way things are. Tattvamasi.
Medieval society in the West, comparable to Hindu society, allowed people to check out of the game. It revered and encouraged hermits, monks, nuns of various types of discipline. And even a person who joined, there's this difference, you see, for the West and India. You couldn't join the Brahmana caste, the priest caste, from some other caste. But in the European caste system, by becoming a priest or a cleric of any kind, you see, a cleric means simply a literate person. The word cleric is related to the word clever. It simply means you're literate, and only the clergy. The word clever, cleric, clerk, clergy are all the same. And they are also related to the word clear, as it was originally spelled C-L-E-R-E. Now, you could join the clerical caste from any other caste, and the function of the clerical caste in the West is that it was across, as it were, a kind of diagonal caste. You could familiarize with any other caste once you're in that one. And so it was a wonderful way of rising in society. You could, from being a serf, go to being a priest, to being an archbishop, and consort with the nobility. It was the only way open to cross castes, you see. And because they were the literate people, it was through literacy and through universities founded by clerics that our caste system began to break. And we got the idea of choosing your own vocation and not simply following what your parents did. Now, I want to make an observation here about checking out of the game. This is not encouraged in contemporary society. Because the Catholic Church and the Episcopalian Church are very powerful minorities, they can still support monasteries and even hermits. But you can't be one on your own without great difficulty. Firstly, because you're a poor consumer. See, around here, we have a number of hermits. There's a guy out there building that boat, and he's essentially a non-joiner, a poor consumer, and the community, they live a lot along here, and they're not working-class people. They are people who dropped out of college because they saw it was stupid. And they're that sort of people. We would call them perhaps beatniks. But you see, the city doesn't like it because they aren't owning the right sort of cars, and therefore the local car salesman isn't doing business through them. They don't have lawns, and so nobody can sell them lawnmowers. They hardly use dishwashers, appliances of that kind. They don't need them. And also they wear blue jeans and things like that, and so the local dress shops feel a bit put out having these people around. And they live very simply. Well, you mustn't do that. You've got to live in a complicated way. You've got to have the kind of car, you know, that identifies you as a person of substance and status and all that. So there's a great problem here in our society. Now, why is there this problem? There's always a very inconsiderable minority of these non-joiners or people who check out of the game. But you will find that insecure societies are the most intolerant of those who are non-joiners. They are so unsure of the validity of their game rules that they say everyone must play. Now that's a double bind. You can't say to a person, you must play, because what you're saying is, you are required to do something which will be acceptable only if you do it voluntarily. You see? So everyone must play is the rule in the United States, and it's the rule in almost all Republican governments. I mean Republican in the sense of democratic. Because they're very uneasy. Because everybody is responsible. You mean you may try not to be and avoid it and say, oh, let the senators take care of it or the president. But theoretically, everyone's responsible. Now, that's terrifying. See, it's all right when you know what's right. There is an aristocracy, there is the clergy, and they know what should be done, and they're used to ruling, you see. But now it's in your hands. You say, well, what are we going to do? Well, I think this way, and you think that way, and he thinks the other way. And so we're all unsettled. And therefore, we become more and more conformist. Individualism, rugged individualism, always leads to conformism, because people get scared. And so they herd together. They were and it compounded with industrial society, mass production, etc. They all wear the same clothes, and they're sensible clothes that don't show the dirt too much. And we get duller and drabber, and with the exception of the Californian Revolution. all the time, I mean, you go to New York and everybody looks as if they were about to attend a funeral. Well, part of the reason is the city is covered in filth. Murk descends, soot descends from the chimneys of Consolidated Edison. It comes in at all the windows, you can't shut it out. So the girls wear black and pearls, and even black underwear, because it just doesn't show the dirt. And all the men wear sensible dark gray suits and black neckties and so on. I mean, it doesn't show the dirt, but it looks like a funeral, or it looks like an assembly of preachers. So the reason for this is, in a way, that democracy as we have tried it started out on the wrong foot. You see, in the scriptures, the Christian scriptures, it says everybody is equal in the sight of God. Now that's a mystical utterance. That means that from the standpoint of God, all people are divine and are playing their true function. And that is something that is true on a certain plane of consciousness. But come down a step and try to apply the mystical insight in the practical affairs of everyday life, and what do you get? You get a parody of mysticism. You get the idea not that everybody is equal in the sight of God, but that all people are equally inferior. And that's why all bureaucracies are rude, why the police are rude, and why you are made to wait in lines and are obstreperous income tax individuals and all that sort of person. Because everybody's a crook. Everybody's equally inferior. See, that becomes the parody of democracy. And that kind of society, watch out for it. It turns in a quick click into fascism, and into, because of its terror of the outsider. Now, a free and easy society loves outsiders. In fact, it's a little bad for the outsider's integrity, because he becomes the holy man, see? And people make salams and give him food and all that. They really take care of the outsider, because they know that man is doing for us what we haven't got the guts to do. That outsider who lives up there in the mountain is at the highest peak of human evolution. His consciousness is one with the divine. And great, just there is someone like that around. It makes you feel a little better. He is realized. He knows what it's all about. And so we need a number of those people. Even though they don't join our game, they tell us, you see, what you're doing is only a game. It's okay, I'm not going to condemn you, but it is only a game, and we up on that mountaintop are watching you. We love you. We have compassion for you. And but we excuse, please, we aren't going to join. So that gives the community great strength, because it tells the government in no uncertain terms that there's something more than government. That's why kings, wise kings, kept not only priests, but court fools. The court fool is much more effective than the priest, to remind the king that after all he's human. And you know how in Richard II, where the fool is called the antic, the king says, within the hollow crown that rounds the mortal temples of a king keeps death his watch. And there the antic sits, scoffing at his state and grinning at his pomp, allowing him a little time to monarchize, be feared, and kill with looks. And then at last comes death, and with a pin bores through his castle wall, and farewell, king. See, always this reminder of the priest or of the antic to the royalty, to the government. You are going to die. You are mortal. Don't give yourself airs and graces as if you were a god. As king, you are only a representative of God. And there is a force, there are domains way, way beyond yours and way, way higher. But it's very difficult for a republican government to realize that, because it's insecure. And therefore, in our present world, you cannot abandon nationality without the greatest difficulty. People who try to abandon nationality get constantly deported from one place to another. You must belong to this thing, as Thoreau put it. However far into the forests you may go, men will pursue you and compel you to belong to their desperate company of oddfellows.